With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, this week's almond update on why almonds have a tremendous opportunity for growth in India. But our top story today, highly pathogenic avian influenza is confirmed in a dairy herd in North Carolina. HPAI has previously been detected in dairy herds in six other states. Mike Davis has more from Raleigh.
North Carolina State veterinarian Dr. Mike Martin says cows from a herd in Texas that had not been showing signs of HPAI were shipped to Idaho, Michigan, and Ohio and subsequently presented clinical signs of the illness there. It was then learned that cows from that same herd had been transported to North Carolina.
USDA recommendations at the time were, you know, we do not test any herds that do not have clinical signs. That was that kind of the recommendations.
Okay.
But because Idaho, Ohio, and Michigan all started having cows that had these signs that then tested positive for high path AI, we went ahead and moved forward with testing this herd preemptively. And it has no clinical signs with this disease. And sure enough, we have been able to isolate highly pathogenic avian influenza virus from this herd.
Movement of cattle from affected herds in these states to North Carolina has now been suspended, but Martin says questions remain as other diseases have been detected, in some cases reported nationwide.
So you start to get evidence on maybe high path AI, maybe it's being opportunistic, right? Maybe it has an immunocompromised individual, and then it makes its way in that way. So the question really is, that's still kind of up in the air, is the high path AI a catalyst disease creating the clinical signs that we're seeing in these herds? Or is it just a tag along opportunistic? And it could be one or the other. I think the jury's still kind of out on that.
Dr. Martin says North Carolina has taken a proactive approach in getting out in front of the outbreak.
No other state has done what we did in North Carolina, right? Nobody else has done this as far as doing this level of investigation and epidemiology. And we did this against the recommendations that were at the time from USDA. So you know, it's easy to second guess from the back seat, but we are doing everything we can to try to protect our animals here in North Carolina and protect the privacy of any of these farms that you know, may be affected either now or in the future with this disease as it's merging.
There are a trio of signs that officials are looking for in affected herds.
These high-producing dairy cattle that, one, go off feed, two, start dropping in milk production, and then three, have those changes in the milk that cause the discoloration and thickening. Now, is that because of high path AI? I don't think we have that answer yet, but that's what got us in this place in the meantime. So maybe high path AI is causing those signs. We're definitely following cattle with those signs, absolutely following them. Does it cause no clinical signs? And so far in this herd, we're not seeing any evidence of clinical signs associated with high path AI.
That's NC State veterinarian Mike Martin. I'm Mike Davis.
The recent USDA-led agricultural trade mission to South Korea was designed to build upon existing relationships to diversify export opportunities to that market. Rod Bain reports.
Some of the numbers associated with USDA's latest agricultural trade mission, a recent visit to South Korea.
Our U.S. delegation included 36 businesses, 12 agricultural associations, and 5 states were represented, including secretaries, directors, or commissioners from Arkansas, California, Indiana, and North Dakota. This was USDA's second trade mission to Korea. The first was in 2018, and it's the second of 7 that we will be hosting this year to support U.S. food and agricultural businesses.
That's Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor, discussing the mission with reporters after returning from South Korea.
Our exporters and businesses that we had with us conducted 616 meetings with potential importers and buyers looking to expand the variety of U.S. food and agricultural products that they're offering to Korean consumers. And those participating companies reported $67 million in projected 12-month sales from those meetings, which are really pretty remarkable numbers.
This builds upon an already strong trade relationship between the two nations and access to a strong export market.
Exports of U.S. food and agricultural products to Korea were just over $8 billion last year in 2023, really built upon the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, but also a really strong and strategic bilateral relationship that we have. That $8 billion of U.S. food and ag exports made Korea our fifth largest single country export market. The top five U.S. agricultural exports related to Korea were beef, pork, seafood, wheat, dried distillers, grain, DDGs, and food preparation. But we also see a lot of diversity going into that market. So we see really strong interest in U.S. fruit and vegetables, nuts, dairy and eggs, coffee, distilled spirits, pet foods, and then consumer packaged goods, condiments, and sauces.
Commenting on the recent mission, two state Ag Department heads and delegation members, Indiana Ag Director Don Lamb and Arkansas Ag Secretary Wes Ward.
My first time to Korea, just learning about building those relationships, learning that culture, and really learning about the political situation that they're in and how that affects us.
We're trying to grow our exports here in Arkansas and diversify our markets, and that certainly was a big topic for this trade mission.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. In today's National Spotlight, there are at least two bright spots in the latest USDA agricultural trade update. Gary Crawford has more.
Even though the latest USDA ag trade update shows exports down from a year ago, that update does have a sprinkling of good news in it. Corn, for example, after months of declining export values, corn sales have crawled back ahead of last year.
Corn exports through February 2024 were $5 billion, up 4% from the previous year.
USDA economist Bart Kinner says very low prices for corn have lured more buyers to it, taking sales value up again by 4%.
Volume of corn exports has 42% increase, so we are exporting a lot more volume. The value is way down.
But that corn at least is moving. Meanwhile, a candidate for most improved sales, it's sorghum.
Sorghum exports are 369% greater than they were at this point last year.
Mostly due to more purchases by China,
which uses sorghum not only for feed, but also for production of liquor product and also industrial use.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Credibility is key with climate-smart commodities. Here's David Geiger.
Getting farmers to produce climate-smart commodities means economic incentives are needed. The USDA has created the Partnerships for Climate-Smart Commodities, investing over $3 billion to do so. But they aren't asking for too much. USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation Robert Bonney thinks farmers have been doing the practices for a while, even if it's not always been called climate-smart.
It's everything from conservation till to cover crops to enhanced efficiency fertilizers. And if they adopt those practices and produce commodities, we're looking for ways to monetize the benefits for those farmers.
Credibility will be key, according to Bonney. They will implement the Growing Climate Solution Act, bipartisan legislation that tries to maintain that public confidence. They will also document the farmers' work on all 135 projects producing dozens of commodities.
All those projects are required to monitor, report, and verify their climate smart practices and the greenhouse gas benefits of those practices.
At the moment, there is a bet of value in the commodity. From the recently produced climate smart rice in Wisconsin to sustainable aviation fuels, Bonnie says ultimately it has to be financially viable.
This has to produce value for producers. That is the most important thing that we're doing. And in order to do that, we've got to make sure both that we get the science right, that we can measure, monitor, that we can keep the costs low.
And find ways for farmers to take advantage of market incentives in the supply chain.
Part of this is to go out and learn by doing, partner with farmers on the ground, figure out ways to create value here. We believe if we create that value, U.S. agriculture is going to be really, really good at this. In fact, we already are really good at it.
Because the end goal is to offer a new avenue of farm production, the program is designed to aggregate all types of producers into common projects and provide an incentive to implement projects. But Bonney says the dollar amount or premium farmers may get for climate smart production will vary from commodity to commodity.
We're going to collect data on these and be as transparent as we can about what the results here. So we're early days here. We probably have 2 million acres enrolled right now, a couple thousand producers, I think. More to come as we roll these projects out. We're going to learn. We're going to learn where the value is in the marketplace here.
I'm David Geiger reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, here's why dairy herd depopulation is not being advised for the current avian influenza outbreak in some dairy operations. USDA's Gary Crawford reports.
So far, veterinary officials are not putting mandatory quarantines around those dairies where some of the cows have contracted avian influenza. Dr. Rosemary Sifford with USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service says also right now there are no plans to depopulate cattle in herds with confirmed bird flu infections. And here's why.
So far, it appears that the cattle are able to recover after a couple of weeks, go back into the milking herd. And so at this point, we do not expect to need to depopulate cattle.
Dairy operators across the country are being asked to step up their biosecurity efforts and to watch their cows for symptoms of avian influenza.
The primary symptoms in dairy cattle are loss of appetite going off feed and then a dramatic drop in milk production. And some of the cattle occasionally showed a slight fever.
She says if you see those symptoms in your herd, contact your vet right away. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
In other livestock news, changing federal policy on milk production may still be a while, but it started moving this month. David Geiger has this report.
The U.S. Agriculture Department will now consider updates to the federal milk marketing order. The deadline for modernization briefs was April 1st. Stephen Kane, an economist with the National Milk Producers Federation, says there is a huge list of requested changes, and the post-hearing gave all interested parties a chance to speak.
To effectively summarize their arguments and give USDA kind of a concise document that outlines why they think the federal order should be amended this way or that way. So really what it was a summarization of what we've been working on for the last 6 months.
That means a close look at what is done with federal orders and making sure it's doing the best work it can for dairy producers. One primary issue is returning to the hire of Class 1 mover.
We made a change a few years ago. Turned out to not be the best decision there. So we're looking to return to the hire of mover, which worked for many years, many decades.
Costs have gone up in 20 years, the last time the order was updated. Other requests look at making sure the system and formulas within orders are reflective of current milk production.
We took a step back, looked at the federal order system, and said, all right, great. These need to be updated, but we can't just update one piece over there that's just going to benefit one side of the industry. We took a holistic approach and updated changes that are beneficial for the entire industry.
Processor representatives have been at these hearings as well. Kane has disagreed with much of what those groups put forth. However, one of the areas they could agree on were adjustments needed to make sure there is enough investment in processing, which also has not been updated in decades.
The make allowances are really the big piece there. We're looking to make some adjustments there to move those up, make sure that we have a healthy processing industry as well as healthy dairy farmers.
The modernization ideas and suggestions will take a while before implementation. USDA recommendations will come in July with finalization at the end of the year. Most decisions won't take effect until quarter one of 2025. I'm David Geiger reporting.
I'm Will Jordan for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Agnet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The Meat and Poultry Products Industry Coalition is contesting the Environmental Protection Agency's proposed wastewater guidelines. The proposed EPA rule expands regulatory reach to include more meat and poultry facilities, prompting opposition from industry and environmental groups. Comprised of several industry associations, the MPP asserts that the guidelines could lead to hundreds of millions in costs, job losses, and facility closures. The coalition notes that according to industry analysis of the EPA's preferred option, it would result in the closure of 74 facilities, not the 16 that EPA has estimated in its proposal. MPP is advocating for a less stringent approach to avoid adverse impacts on the industry and rural job creation. At the same time, environmental groups are advocating for stricter regulations, challenging EPA's preferred option as weak and inconsistent with federal law. The Regional Agriculture Promotion Program was designed to help enable exporters to break into new markets and increase market share in regions experiencing growth. Upon return from a recent trade mission, Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor, explained the value of the program in increasing trade opportunities in South Korea.
We have created and announced the new Regional Agriculture Promotion Program. We have announced the first tranche of funding and accepted applications, and we're currently vetting through those. But we received, of the first $300 million we announced, $35 million worth of project proposals in Korea. So I think it really shows it is a strategic market, is a critical market as we think about market diversification and really cementing and building stronger relationships in this part of the world. And I think our businesses really showcase what opportunities lie for them as we were making those investments.
Cotton producers have a variety of benefits available through the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol. Program manager Tillman White explains an element of the program and how helpful it's been for growers.
We want to remind producers that as part of the Trust Protocol enrollment, they can also apply for the U.S. Climate Smart Cotton Program. The Climate Smart Cotton Program provides participating growers the opportunity to receive financial and technical support, as well as other benefits to enhance their operations. The Climate Smart Cotton Program began less than 1 year ago and has already approved applications for 778 farming entities in Level 1 of the 1,650 available. To date, more than $1.5 million has been paid to these growers. To begin enrollment and applications, growers can visit trustuscotton.org or for questions, email us at info@trustuscotton.org.
The Department of Viticulture and Enology at UC Davis is set to host a virtual workshop with a variety of speakers next week. The Emerging and Future Challenges in Viticulture program will be held via Zoom on Wednesday, April 17th, beginning at 9 in the morning. Viticulture Farm Advisor Monica Cooper will begin with a presentation on the challenges and opportunities for Napa's viticulture industry. That will be followed up by information on rootstock and mesoclimate impacts on wine grape production in the North Coast and the advances and challenges of breeding powdery mildew-resistant grape cultivars. Following the morning break, there will be presentations on grapevine rootstock's response to salinity, an update on the Greenhouse Foundation, including current and future plans, along with an in-depth look at red blotch. More information about the virtual workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
The dairy industry responds to a new WIC final rule. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The National Milk Producers Federation and the International Dairy Foods Association expressed disappointment in Tuesday's final rule to update the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. The final rule maintains the proposed rule's cuts to dairy in the WIC food packages. WIC is a program ensuring that pregnant women, new mothers, infants, and children have access to key nutrients that may be lacking in their diets. NMPF President and CEO Greg Dowd says, "This rule works against the WIC program's goal of ensuring all Americans have consistent and equitable access to healthy, safe, and affordable foods. Milk, cheese, and yogurt are three of the five top redeemed items through WIC, according to the NMPF and IDFA. While disappointed in the cuts to the dairy allotments, the groups appreciate the rule's requirement that states offer lactose-free milk and a wider selection of product package sizes." Senator John Hoeven, a senior member of the Senate Agriculture Committee and ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Appropriations Committee, this week introduced the Federal Agriculture Risk Management Enhancement and Resilience, or FARMER, Act. Hoeven says the legislation will strengthen crop insurance and make higher levels of coverage more affordable for producers across the country.
Essentially, what it does is it puts more farm in the farm bill. And that's what we need to do. To get this farm bill passed, we need more farm in the farm bill. What does that mean? That means we've got to enhance crop insurance, which is exactly what this bill does. And we have to strengthen the countercyclical safety net, ARC and PLC, because that is the safety net. That is the risk management structure for our farmers and ranchers across this country. So it's vitally important. And that's what we mean. And you'll hear me say it. You'll hear our ranking members say it. You'll hear all of us say it. We need more farm in this farm bill in order to get it passed. And so this legislation specifically strengthens crop insurance. And how does it do it? It does it in two ways. One, by enhancing the buy-up, providing more support to buy a higher level of coverage, and that it actually provides then higher levels of coverage on a more affordable basis, not only at the enterprise level, so not only at the farm level, but also at the supplemental coverage option level, which is incredibly important that you have that. And in addition to providing that on a more affordable basis, It also directs that USDA evaluate and determine how they can make crop insurance more affordable and work better when you have large counties in your state. So Iowa's kind of set up perfectly, right, for crop insurance because it's a square state, not real big geographically, and they have 99 counties that are all like perfectly square in the same size. So SCO works pretty darn, and surprising, I don't find that surprising given the strong leadership of Grassley and Harkin over many years on a bipartisan basis, that it works great in Iowa. Good job, RMA, but it went for states like, I don't know, let's just pick some at random. North Dakota, there's one. Arkansas, there's another one. Texas, where you have large counties, it needs some work. And so this is all about making the number one risk management tool that our farmers use better. Gee, what a good idea for a farm bill. And if this is included, then I think our chances to pass this farm bill this year get much, much better.
Hovind says the Farmer Act is better for taxpayers, too.
It's good for all Americans. Think about it. We talk about a farm bill being for farmers and ranchers. But a good farm bill is for every single American. Think about it. Our farmers and ranchers produce the highest quality, lowest cost food supply in the world. And every American benefits from that every single day. And remember, it's food, fuel, and fiber. But just from a food standpoint, every single day, every single American benefits from the highest quality, lowest cost food supply brought to us by our farmers and ranchers. Americans spend less of their budget than any other developed country on their food, and they have better food and a better choice, right? It's national security. We don't have to worry about food security, right?
Co-sponsors of the bill include Senate Agriculture Committee ranking member John Bozeman.
I was hoping that at this point in the year we would be able to be talking about having a farm bill completed. The good news is everybody's working in good faith to try and get that done. We're working closely with Senator Stab now, and then our House, the chairman and ranking member of the House, again, trying to put these things together so we can move forward. It's so important. The reason that risk management is vital is when you look at the income of our farmers last couple of years, greatest loss ever. We're looking at all of the economists that I talk to, including the USDA, our land grants. Find anyone that doesn't say it, we're projected to have significant losses in farm income on top of the last couple of years. So it really is, our risk management tools simply don't work right now. It's with a lady, one of the corn producers that was in the other day from Minnesota, and she penciled out for me her input cost, what she projected her yield, and then her marking, basis on that, which was actually a little bit higher than it actually was. But it just doesn't work. So we've got to get these things updated. This is really a good step in the right direction. So we're interested in getting crop insurance where it works better. It is the underpinning of these things, but also making sure that ARC and PLC, getting our reference prices, all of the tools that we need as we go forward. So we will be continuing to work again with our House and our partner in the Senate, Senator Stabenow. She and I have a very, very good relationship, and so continue to try and get a farm bill passed. But this is a good step in the right direction as far as thinking outside the box. What do we do now in this very special time to make it such that the tools that our farmers have actually work?
Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith is supporting the legislation as lawmakers continue to negotiate the pieces of the new farm bill.
So we have got to get this done, folks. We have got to get this right. I mean, we're talking a $1.5 trillion bill here. I think we can get a little bit more in there for those producers that can produce the substances we have to have, that can provide that nutrition that is so critical there. So thank you for your work on this. Thank you for your attention to this. And you said it just so perfectly. I mean, Senator Hovind just started us off here and laid it out completely exactly what's happening. We want to get along. We want to work on the committee with other members. But folks, we got to stick to our guns on this. We have got to make sure we increase that small percentage there so the other half, the other 80%, more than the other half, can continue to do what they do, what we enjoy every single day. But you got to look at the farm bill. You have to look at past farm bills, what's been successful. We've got to make sure we get it right. It's going to be a few years before we do this again. We cannot give in now and say, okay, this is suitable, because it's not suitable. It's not acceptable. So thank you guys for sticking with us, for being here, that we can move forward on this with a much better outcome.
Roger Marshall of Kansas says producers in his state have told him that lawmakers need to take care of crop insurance in the next farm bill.
We point out that crop insurance maybe is 5 to 10% of a farm bill. And though the people in this room understand this, I think most consumers don't, that a farmer would much rather harvest a crop than collect crop insurance. A crop, no farmer makes any profit from crop insurance. Again, it allows us to plant next year's crops, which helps keep the cost of foods down in the long term. You know, it's not surprising that crop insurance, the cost of crop insurance to the farmers has gone up and up and up, because it's going to parallel the input costs that they've got. Banks out there are not going to make a loan on any type of farmer unless they have crop insurance. And when your input costs go up, diesel and fertilizers, the value of that crop is going to go up, so it would make sense that crop insurance is going to have to go up as well. Meanwhile, commodity prices down 10 or 20%, and that's resulted in the largest decline in farmer income we've seen year over year in decades as well. So all these reasons add up to why we need to support Senator Hovind's bill and make sure that this is included in a farm bill. If we get this piece of the puzzle solved, the rest of the farm bill is going to fall in line.
Patrick Johnson is the vice chairman of the National Cotton Council. His group supports the legislation.
The public-private crop insurance program is really a cornerstone of the farmer safety net, and farmers want crop insurance and farmers need crop insurance.
Hovind's legislation is supported by the American Farm Bureau and several other agricultural organizations. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has this week's Almond Update.
Today's Almond Update includes this month's marketing bulletin from the Almond Board of California.
Back in February, Almond Board of California staff embarked on their annual trip to India, this time led by President and CEO Clarice Turner, her first trip to the region at the helm of ABC, and her first time back to the market for some time. Turner's trip included participation in an almond conference hosted by ABC and attendance at the renowned Gulf Food Show, where she shared insights into the burgeoning potential for almond trade in India and showcased California almonds on the global stage. Turner, reflecting on her experiences in India, expressed profound enthusiasm about reconnecting with the vibrant Indian culture and exploring new avenues for almond trade.
My take on India is that there's a tremendous opportunity for growth. The Almond Board hired Deloitte to come in and look at our growth strategy, and they too highlighted India as potential for growth. Specifically, you know, if you don't know, India, half the population in India is under 30 years old, and they have increasing awareness and are placing more value on health and what they eat, probably in thanks to COVID and raising that awareness. But that population is also growing and is now the largest in the world and has favorable macroeconomic conditions at this point, and also political, which adds a layer of stability, which makes markets attractive, of course. And then underlying there is a cultural propensity for almonds, which is terrific because almonds have been part of Indian culture for a very long time. In fact, they're part of Ayurveda, which is having sort of a resurgence in population with younger people, and because it does talk a lot about health.
During the ABC-hosted conference in India, Turner engaged in discussions with industry leaders, including ABC's own Sudarshan Mazumdar, to dissect market dynamics and formulate strategic growth initiatives.
We are so lucky to have Sudarshan in market because he is all things almonds. And it was very evident the respect that he commands and the vastness of his network when we were there, along with the partners that we leverage in the market to deliver our programs over there and help us to think through strategically about where we go from here. The conference that we held had a lot of different pieces and parts to it, really great discussions that were facilitated by Julie Adams and our trade and regulatory leader. And we talked a lot about just the market dynamics of what's going on in India. You know, what is the volumes that are coming in? How's it coming in? What's the tariff situation? What does it look like in the future? Lots of different background on all the moving parts, because it is a fairly complicated market. Certainly lots of growth there, but also very complicated. We did talk about, and we had Deloitte present some numbers in terms of growth of Indian population, where we see that going, which segments are growing, where they're growing. And to your point, Taylor, we talked about tier two and tier three markets and how we can expand and grow in India. Deloitte particularly identified fresh nuts and snack nuts as a short-term opportunity, and then confection and more ingredient-based ice cream snack bars and breakfast cereal as longer-term potential growth areas. So that whole part of the Indian trade is growing, but in-shell is still number one and will continue to be for some time.
ABC has created an India Market Task Force, and at the conference met with a newly formed India Nut and Dried Fruit Council. Turner said all of the collaboration is aimed at navigating the intricacies of the market and capitalizing on emerging opportunities.
It's a gift, really, to have collaboration across all the specialty crop channels in the industry, because we're all facing so many of the very same things. And in many cases, you know, people who are doing business in one channel are also doing it in another. So it was great, similar to, you know, what we see at INC, having various people talking about their different categories across the couple of days that the conference was hosted. It's always great to hear the insights that are coming from different categories to figure out how we can collaborate together and how we can learn from each other, frankly, because we share a lot of the same opportunities and a lot of the same pain.
Transitioning to the Gulf Food Show, Turner described it as a global epicenter for food and beverage, attracting attendees from diverse regions. ABC's presence at the event was marked by showcasing the superior quality of California almonds and engaging in discussions on market access and distribution.
Specifically, you know, within our booth, it's a trade show, so we are representing almonds as a category, and we're talking a lot about at those shows typically about how we grade almonds, the type of almonds that we produce in California, and right down to the varieties and the rootstocks, and, you know, in some cases really getting into the nitty-gritty of what makes one different than another. And there's a lot of questions about taste and shelf life and, you know, size. And so our poster of the sizes of all the different varieties of almonds is usually wildly popular. So we wind up in a lot of conversations around those things. And then also around distribution. And, you know, we always have the handler list with us, and we give that out to people who are wanting to buy almonds. But there's a lot of conversation around, particularly, why are California almonds amazing? Why can we produce such quantity with the level of quality that we can produce consistently year after year after year? That matters to the trade a great deal. And so telling them, you know, our story in terms of our Mediterranean climate and our wonderful legacy of farmers that we've had in the state, particularly in the almond industry, for almost 175 years. It's really fun to be able to tell those stories and interact and, you know, give people whatever information they're after. And it's a variety of things, but it's really engaging, and it's developing relationships literally all around the world.
ABC's marketing initiatives, including new innovative commercials blending tradition with modernness, garnered significant attention at the two shows. Turner said the new ads were debuted during the trip, promoting California almonds and resonating with global consumers.
It does a really nice job of blending tradition with 21st century, because there's this whole thing about swipe left and swipe right in the commercial, which is just so well executed. And there's several versions of it. I think there's 8 versions. So they did a really nice job at maximizing all that goes into, you know, setting up to film something like that. But it's just, it makes me smile every time I see it. The music is perfect. The acting is perfect. The set design, costume design, really, really great, and it showcases the health of almonds and the impact in this case on skin and hair.
And that's this month's Marketing Bulletin from the Almond Board of California.
You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. Animal disease experts are collecting a massive amount of data on the outbreak of avian influenza in dairy herds. Gary Crawford has more.
It started back in mid-March when dairy operators in Texas and Kansas began noticing some of their animals were showing signs of illness, which turned out to be avian influenza. On March 25th, lab tests confirmed the presence of highly pathogenic avian influenza in cattle from two dairies in Texas and two in Kansas. Since then, there have been confirmations of bird flu infections among cattle in Michigan, New Mexico, Idaho, and Ohio. That was as of this past Thursday, April 4th. Livestock disease experts are working to find out more about how dairy cattle are coming down with avian influenza. Dr. Rosemary Sifford with the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service told us,
it is really important at this time for us to receive information about these herds and receive samples from these herds so that we can get a more clear picture of exactly what's going on. And so we have epidemiologists who are working with producers to gather up information, and we're working with our state animal health officials to get samples into the lab for testing. All of that information helps us to understand much more clearly what role high path avian influenza is playing in this overall illness in dairy cattle and what we can do to more effectively prevent it in the future. And so looking at that data and those test results, we will continue to develop recommendations for producers for how to control and prevent the illness that they're seeing in dairy cattle at this time.
So far, veterinary officials are not putting mandatory quarantines around those dairies where some of the cows have contracted avian influenza. Dr. Rosemary Sifford also says right now there are no plans to depopulate cattle in herds with confirmed bird flu infections, and here's why.
So far, it appears that the cattle are able to recover after a couple of weeks, go back into the milking herd. And so at this point, we do not expect to need to depopulate cattle.
Dairy operators across the country are being asked to step up their biosecurity efforts and to watch their cows for symptoms of avian influenza.
The primary symptoms in dairy cattle are loss of appetite going off feed and then a dramatic drop in milk production. And some of the cattle occasionally show a slight fever.
If you see those symptoms in your herd, contact your vet right away. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A weather system currently over the south central U.S. is moving eastward and expected to provide a myriad of active weather conditions during its trek. Rod Bain has more.
Active weather continues over much of the nation, currently in the form of a storm system crossing the south central U.S. this week.
That system is fueling heavy rain, some locally severe thunderstorms across the south.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey adds this system is a slow mover.
This system is going to take its time, first drifting into the mid-south, then moving northeastward into the eastern Corn Belt by Thursday. The system will eventually move northward and weaken across eastern Canada late in the week.
With active weather from this system expected over the next 5 days, including thunderstorms and potential heavy winds, hail, and tornadoes.
The bigger story, I think, with this system will be the widespread heavy rain. Pretty much everybody east of a line from East Texas to Lake Michigan will see at least an inch of rain with this system.
With impacts ranging from beneficial crop moisture to possible flash flooding and field work delays. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.